Hello and welcome to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner here with you. And today, in the first of a two-part series, we're taking a music-fueled tour back three decades or so to the generation of youth who grew up in a world before the arrival of the internet and the mobile phone. The years 1977 to 1983 saw an explosion of musical creativity in inner-city Sydney and Melbourne. Following the do-it-yourself revolution of punk, many young Australians were inspired to make challenging music that defied traditional boundaries, to form bands and start independent labels, and to run live music venues, all outside the commercially driven confines of the mainstream industry. This groundbreaking activity laid the foundation for contemporary music in Australia, and the vital output from the period, which has come to be known as post-punk, gained an international reputation. Over the next 2 weeks on Hindsight, we'll be tracing the rise of the post-punk movement, first in Sydney, then in Melbourne, and the creative ferment of music, art and other cultural forms, which continue to resonate to this day. In Sydney, the post-punk music scene revolved around a social set based in the terrace houses and industrial spaces of then run-down inner-city Darlinghurst and Surrey Hills. Bands shared living spaces, rehearsal rooms, equipment and members, forging sounds without precedence. And for the first time in the contemporary music scene, women were taking their place as equal and integral players. Inner-city pubs and clubs, faced with a dwindling clientele of working men, opened their doors to these art punk bands, and an enthusiastic audience soon followed. Set in a Sydney landscape far removed from the city's usual sun and seaside imagery, here's part one of Do That Dance, Australian post-punk.
Remember when people thought Elvis Presley was bad because he swiveled his hips? Elvis, the pelvis? Or remember when parents were paranoid about the Beatles because they had long hair, or frightened by the Rolling Stones because they didn't seem to wash all that often? Those groups pale in comparison with the new wave of rock groups, the punk rockers. Punk rock began in England with bands like the Sex Pistols, and now it's spread to Australia.
Punk was born in downtown New York and London in the mid-1970s. By 1977, punk had arrived in Australia. The era now known as post-punk would shortly follow, with an explosion of underground, experimental and independent music. From 1977 to 1983, Sydney's inner-city community of musicians and artists had fun, broke cultural boundaries and helped to set the trends for contemporary music.
There was a large group of us, you know, I mean, Secret, the Thought Criminals, Tactics, God, there were so many of them, but we all lived in Darlinghurst. We all knew each other. We all sort of ran into each other constantly on the street or at the dole office. We all were playing gigs the whole time, talking about our music, talking about making film, that people in the band were making the films with me. It was what they call a fertile environment.
Practice rooms were very cheap, instruments were sort of shared around. There was always practices going on in the house where I lived. And yeah, I think there was greater freedom then to sort of pursue that sort of experience.
Well, we lounged around, we slept late, we drank, we'd listen to a lot of records, we'd practice in the middle of the night.
I ran on spirit. I think there was a really good spirit around.
It really did feel like there was a whole series of people who were all connected, but not, well, we didn't feel like a group, you know, we didn't feel like a collective or anything like that. It was simply that we were connected in terms of shared interests, our shared views on life. our shared love of music and our shared love of making music.
Fun. Fun, two, three, four. I want to go out in a garbage bag. I want to come home all covered in rags. I want to go out, get pissed, get pissed. I want to come home and slash my wrist. I don't want no ELB for me. I don't want no anarchy. I just want to have fun. Fun, 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 yes, fun.
The late 1970s zeitgeist.
There was nothing particularly conservative about the 70s. It was the post-Goff year, so it wasn't that conservative.
Bass player with the Thought Criminals, Roger Grierson.
The risk of sounding like Jermaine Greer was free love and free ideas and smoke as much dope as you can and everybody have fun and hang loose. In those days, everything was moving forward. It was moving forward really quickly. Social mores were changing. Everything was heading in a new direction. Technology was improving. Music was improving. People's attitudes were becoming more enlightened. It was just a time of experimentation and people just having some fun with it. I want to take drugs until my brain falls out.
Stand in the centre of town and shout. I don't want no... Bass player and singer with the XL Capris, Joanna Piggott.
We had everything. You know, we had free university education. We had good education. I mean, I left school when the Whitlam era started, so the whole country sort of opened up the possibilities of who you could be and what you could do.
Lead singer with Pell Mell, Judy McGee.
It sounds like sort of, oh, back in my day, but we didn't need much. We shopped in op shops. Furniture was kind of milk crates, really, and the odd pallet. The houses didn't even have phones. I think we might have eventually got a phone. We probably did because, you know, we were organising running a band. Yeah, we didn't...
You didn't have cars?
Didn't have cars.
Very rarely.
Didn't even have a push bike. It was, you know, you lived hand to mouth and it was pretty basic, but that was fine.
Through real punk, you got a whole influx of new people that weren't virtuoso players. You can play three chords, you can make a band. And there was a political reason for it all. It was a finger to the way the sort of bloated rock industry was assuming everything would go. That's how we felt at the time, you know. It was like cheeky and rude.
We were bored shitless with everything that was just happening, you know. And we put rock and roll together. We were the fast rock and roll, dancing rock and roll. We don't consider ourselves to be fantastic musicians. We consider, you know, we're a fantastic punk band.
Here's original Sydney punk, you know, Johnny Dole, really recorded in the Double J studio in 1978.
The main thing, we want people to enjoy themselves. You know, the only thing is I'm getting a bit sick of being bad at.
It happens a lot, doesn't it?
It happens quite a lot. The drums were covered in it last week.
Where do you play as a rule?
Normally the Grand Hotel. One, two, three, four!
The Grand Hotel, long since demolished, stood opposite Railway Square.
The Grand Hotel was very, very punk, you know, and people just all in black. Pogoing. That was fantastic, you know. That was just such a powerful feeling.
Singer with the Particles, Astrid Spielman.
Wow, we must have been so full of energy then. You'd do that for hours. We were all dressed looking really tough and really scary, and then we'd go out on the street and we'd sort of snarl at people, kind of like, man, what's your problem looking at us?
Punk, for what it was worth, and for all of its everybody be themselves and all that sort of stuff, was actually a fairly narrow aesthetic and had its own set of rules you couldn't break.
Roger Grierson.
So people wanted to move beyond that, breaking away the confines of the 4-4 box of punk. The post-punk era took the DIY aspect of punk and suddenly it became far more creative and anything went. Suddenly it became you could do anything and it was kind of art. It was inevitable, really, that Sydney would spawn some kind of experimental scene.
Voight 465 were one of Sydney's first identifiably post-punk bands. With angular rhythms, blasts of sound from an analogue synthesiser and a female lead singer. Songwriter and keyboardist, Phil Turnbull.
Well, for me, it was the fact that you were energised by punk. You wanted to do it yourself. You wanted to play more than a riff on old-style rock and roll. All the influences were just swirling around. It was never a matter of trying to follow something I don't think. We were never musicians. We were just people that love music. Most of us all came from the same high school, Sydney Tech Boys at Bexley. We were mucking around at Rod's father's factory. He owned a factory down at Sutherland Way. So we started learning our instruments in just a typical, you know, garage band style thing. And initially it also started off with me writing some very loose sort of systems-based music, and we all tried to play that. Plus we also started picking up more and more on the energised, punky aspects. And so we started playing faster. And it became this really tight little sort of really strange thing. It just merged into something that sounds quite fluid.
The Sussex Hotel, a rundown corner pub in Sydney's CBD, quickly became a hub for emerging music scenes, the punks and mods mingling at the bar with working men. Late 1978, Voight 465 took up residency.
The Sussex was a bit punky, but a bit sort of more arty punky. Basically all of our friends turned up there, people who turned into our friends. So in the bottom lower bar was where all the bands used to play. Had this big curved bar and a little bit of space, and then you sort of tuck yourself in the corner. The toilet's around there, so every time anyone went to the toilet, they had to walk past the band. So we played there Wednesday nights for a long time. We charged a big 50 cents to get in.
And was this being run by Stella at the time?
That's right, yes. So Stella was a fantastic woman. She was just this amazing, craggy old thing who just really didn't care. She just really enjoyed seeing us enjoying ourselves.
One Saturday afternoon, Voight 465 had a concert in the industrial wasteland of Darling Harbour. They set up under the concrete pylons of the Eastern Distributor Freeway, then under construction.
We loved Darling Harbour in that nascent phase where it was, you know, real industrial waste in Darling Harbour itself. It was an awful place. Going down there and having those huge pylons being built was just an amazing thing. It looked like Stonehenge or something like that at that stage.
Sydney's inner city industrial scape was in decay by the late 1970s. Pre-gentrification, young people were moving in from the suburbs to occupy the cheap or free space in which to create.
All the squats around the area that's now the Eastern Distributor, the Gladstone Hotel where the Reels lived, all the Palmer Street squats. There were a lot of squats in that strip and a lot of buildings in the inner city that you could crash in. The Southern Cross Hotel, which is now the Vibe Hotel in Goulburn Street, that whole building was an abandoned office block. And there would have been 300 people living there, squatting.
Well, Surry Hills was kind of inspiring because it basically got taken over by young people because the terrace houses were so cheap. You could
rent and share a house, the opportunity for people to actually live, create and play. So you need those three things. Have enough room for your instruments. Some people used a room to actually record, you know, using four tracks. So the front rooms were good, but then people kind of moved it up a notch and managed to get rehearsal spaces which they shared. So the Pie Factory, which is the old Sargent's Pie Factory, quite famous, right in the centre of Darlinghurst, which is now very groovy apartments. There was a whole series of rehearsal rooms in there where people shared equipment and played. They had these huge, big, thick doors and you walked down a strange kind of corridor. But outside the rooms, it was completely silent. You wouldn't know that there was all these people in these almost catacombs playing strange music.
Decades before the web, creative inspiration could be found exploring the second-hand stores, drab arcades, and record shops of weird old Sydney. Patrick Gibson.
I used to love when I started getting into records, going into Gould's Book Arcade with their pictures of Karl Marx and dusty old copies of Das Kapital in the background, and just hundreds of thousands of records by bands the likes of which you'd probably never want to hear and have been completely forgotten. Just a massed culture that's just the dustbin of history.
Severed Heads frontman Tom Ellard.
1978 was when I was in fifth grade of high school and would go record shopping, and the local record shop had a bin where they'd put anything they thought I might like, you know, all the weird stuff would go in the bin. And I'd go in there and I would hear things like, for example, TVOD by the Normal. So, yeah, there was a lot of stuff coming in from overseas, and it would be an album that you'd heard described in a magazine that had been brought by sea, so it probably is 3 months old by the time you got to read about the band. So to make it very clear, you could not investigate a piece of music simply by flicking through a website.
I don't need a TV screen. I just stick the aerial into my skin.
The ABC's youth station, 2JJ, began broadcasting in 1975, initially just in Sydney. In the punk and post-punk years, the station proved to be influential on the local scene.
Double J, well, okay, I mean, it was invented in this period. Up front, it was very comparatively anarchic. The particular DJ I would listen to most would be on at 10 o'clock at night, and that would be Peter Doyle. And Peter Doyle would be playing the latest releases coming in from England and America with an accent on what we now call post-punk.
Double J would have been an essential education musically.
It was for me, yes. All these other strange bands that would be played by the likes of Peter Doyle or Tony Barrell or Mac Cocker, it was mighty, mighty exciting at the time, just knowing that people were doing this weird stuff.
Producer Tony Barrell was with Youth Network 2JJ and then Triple J from 1978 to 1981.
When 1976, 77 burst on the scene with all the bands that came through with the punk movement, Double J was probably the only radio station in Australia playing that stuff. Because music was changing in ways which were quite gargantuan, people had to either go with it or resist it, you know, and the station did both. You had just had to look around what was going on and see how many bands there were all over the country, not just in Sydney, to realise that this was a genuine movement. There was a recasting of the landscape of popular culture, and it was widespread and common, and it was in every country in Europe and North America. This is entertainment.
This is fun. Did you have a sense of who you were broadcasting to?
I always thought it was kids in bedrooms. In a sense, that was what it was. It was the idea that your parents wouldn't like this, so, you know, this is the radio station for you. Oh, yeah, I think a lot of people who listened and heard stuff thought to themselves, oh, I can do that. They just got the idea that sound and music had moved into a different sphere and that it was less and less corporate.
Can you tell us a little bit about Double J's role in actually opening the doors to burgeoning musicians and recording them and getting their music played on air?
Well, there weren't many sound engineers who were keen enough to record people who weren't really up to the mark, in their opinion. However, there was one, and that was Graham Bartlett, who was interested in the new wave and the punk thing from a sociological and aesthetic perspective, and he managed to commandeer the only multi-track machine we had. And he would invite people to come in sometimes on the weekend, and we'd make a demo single in a small back room. Patrick Gibson, you know, he was only a teenager at the time. He came in. Oh, I think Graham, when he listened to the cassette, just thought, oh, this is great. This is what we're doing, you know. This is what we should be doing. The systematics were just kids playing in a bedroom. And, well, that's why we're doing them, because they're kids playing in a bedroom. And that's as real and as authentic and as interesting as anything else that's going on.
Living in disposal ships and rotting in a hole. Then you, poor baby, you and I. Carrying a megaton and hiding from the trees. Poor baby, you and I. Oh, I don't call my baby, baby, I call our baby, baby, but not my baby. My love is like a piece of fruit that's rotting in a bowl. It's soft and brown and starts to stink if it's not thrown away. I feel like a red bag when I'm in the kitchen of our home. And I have my peel banana cooked into the blender of your mix master. And come up with a pop baby, pop baby, pop baby. Pop baby, pop baby, pop baby. Pop baby, pop baby, pop baby.
I speak with Systematics frontman, Patrick Gibson. Pulp Baby, the song itself, was that a cry of teen angst or just a bit of Dadaist absurdity?
Yeah, Surreal Australiana. Yes, it was teen angst. Sort of a whole polymorphous thing about a mix master.
Was it the classic bedroom band? Was it you in your bedroom with a synthesizer?
That's exactly what it was. And two radio cassette recorders, which I'd use to bounce material back and forth so I could do overdubs. And, yeah, my parents were nice enough to buy me a Roland 101, and I used to play and record it when I probably should have been out surfing or playing football, but, you know. And indeed, that whole punk thing, the DIY sort of thing, that you could indeed, you know, just do stuff in your bedroom and possibly even release it and get people to listen to it.
Patrick Gibson teamed up with local friends, guitarist Michael Filewood and keyboardist Fiona Graham, first to perform at John Blade's 21st, and then to conquer the inner Sydney scene.
I think we were hoping to God we could get away from the northern beaches, really. We were looking forward desperately to get into the inner city because it was where everything was happening.
Company.
The near-empty pubs, clubs and nightclubs of the inner city started opening their doors to live music, drawing in a new, younger crowd.
Checkers, oh, what a lovely dive.
Mitch Jones.
Downstairs, it was like walking into sort of Vegas nightclub that somebody stripped all the furniture out of and just left the tacky carpet. And was all these sort of different rooms and it was always underlit. So you always think, well, what's in these shadows? Am I going to be mugged walking through this place?
Act like that. Luther's mass reaction troops attack.
The Rock Garden, which was on
William Street.
Halfway up William Street, and it was sort of shared a building with the rebuilt Whiskey A Go Go. Brownies in Paddington on Oxford Street.
St. Peter's Parish Hall on Devonshire Street. We used to go and have to visit Father Shahady and sit down with him and say, we promise there won't be any trouble and it's going to be very, very noisy. And he'd be, okay, fine, because he just wanted to see the hall getting used.
Warehouses that were not being used, that people had moved into, industrial spaces like Art Unit. Side Effects was like almost a community space that people could use. It was an amazing time for music. I think young people were very open to listening to different types of music. So let's get with the
times. Patrick Gibson, Mitch Jones and Michael Coffey recall the legendary Sydney Trade Union Club, which stood on Favo Street in the rag trade district of Surry Hills.
The Trade Union Club was a mainstay in Sydney. It was kind of the place.
It was a trade union club, but you didn't have to sign in. It depends on sort of what the cops were saying to them, I think. I think there were a lot of backhanders went to the cops for that place. But the old trade union members would still be there drinking, no matter the racket going on. If they were there drinking till whenever, they'd still be there.
You could fit about 900 people upstairs at the top, and there was just one little tiny mini elevator to get up there.
And one staircase.
One
staircase. No stairs.
So and the stage was very, very tiny, but it just had a great sound.
Drummer with the Brisbane band The Go-Betweens, Lindy Morrison, recalls a seminal triple bill in the now-demolished Paris Theatre on Oxford Street.
There was a legendary gig and The Go-Betweens were the first band on, followed by The Laughing Clowns, followed by The Birthday Party. It was a legendary gig because it was the first time the three of us had played together in Sydney and we felt a great sympathy for each other's music, and I had been really caught up with The Laughing Clowns in Brisbane. One of the greatest inspirations for me was Jeffrey Wagner's drumming. It was a very, very arty audience. It was sensational because you knew that you were creating such authentic music, such unusual, original, authentic music. We had nothing to do with the mainstream in Australia. We weren't even near the edges, really. We were out there, you know. We were three most unusual bands. No one was kind of getting it, really, at that stage, except for the people who did get it.
And then there was the ABC's pop music TV show, Countdown.
We used to watch Countdown every Sunday night at 6 o'clock, mainly to just be outraged by the appalling drivel that was on there.
Countdown used to infuriate me. I thought it was just so kind of up itself. There were lots of people in music. None of them were getting on Countdown, you know. Countdown was irrelevant in a way.
We used to always sit down and watch Countdown and just put crap on everything that was on there, and that was like how...
Everyone used to love to hate Countdown.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was sort of, I think it became a national sport, didn't it? Sit down and abuse Countdown.
You're listening to Hindsight, and we're tracing the rise of Sydney's post-punk scene in the late 1970s and early 1980s. 100 kilometres north of Sydney was the coastal town of Newcastle, with BHP's steelworks at its hub. From this industrial landscape would emerge one of Australian post-punk's most successful bands, Pell Mell.
Singing with silence when I wanted music.
No Word from China was both, a political and a personal song. I was probably 17 when I wrote it, so it was ridiculously idealistic and probably also didn't mean very much.
Lead singer with Pell Mell, Judy McGee.
I must admit that women did come to me and say that, oh, you know, you inspired me to da-da-da. The music industry was very conservative in those days, I think, and it was, I guess, a male-dominated industry at that time, but I didn't really take a lot of notice of it, I guess because the bands that we played with and the milieu of people, particularly the little bands that we were, you know, did gigs with often, there were lots of girls. It was actually fine. And I do remember once some fairly serious feminists from Queensland grilling me on this subject. I was about 19, I suppose, and I actually just thought, no, I haven't even really noticed it.
Judy's brother and keyboardist with The Limp, Tim McGee.
In the late 70s, Newcastle was still a very industrial town. Rock and roll-wise, it was a place of suburban kind of beer barns.
You go out to a pub and drink and see a cover band. That was really about, that was it in terms of things to do, or go to the beach. So, yeah, I think that's why we sort of made our own fun.
We basically set up a hotel gig in Newcastle, the Grand Hotel, and Pell Mell played there every Friday night.
Some of those fellas wouldn't have seen a girl like me. Short hair and, you know, wearing a pleated skirt.
We sort of came to the conclusion we needed a support band because Pell Mell were starting to play three or four sets and they were having to double up. They'd run out of songs halfway through the night. And so we set up The Limp really as a kind of support band for Pell Mell.
The Limp was aspiring to just, make some noise, be funny, be out there, break rules. We moved to Sydney, yes, we moved to Sydney. I think it was something that we had to do.
If you live in Newcastle, it's kind of pretty well predestined.
Preordained.
You were going to leave or you're going to get a job in Newcastle and just continue on. But a lot of people will leave almost as soon as they get an opportunity.
And, yeah, because we started playing in Sydney, it started to make sense. You know, there were real places to play down here, not just one venue and... yeah, and it was something we wanted to be a part of, I guess.
One of the Sydney bands that supported Pell Mell were the Tame O'Meara's. Phil Turnbull recalls seeing them live.
A band like the Tame O'Meara's is the epitome of post-punk for me. They tried things new, they spent time at it, they just worked at it, and they created something unique and fascinating and beautiful. I think that's what a lot of the bands were emulating at that time, trying to get to that level.
Multi-instrumentalist with the Tame O'Meara's, Jill O'Mara.
Well, the Tame O'Meara's had a very strange beginning because I was sharing a house with a very talented musician called Lindsay, who'd played in Voight, and he caught me playing his bass one day and he said we should start a band on the basis that, you know, I could play four notes. Although I had played guitar as a teenager, my approach to bass playing was quite strange.
Lindsay's girlfriend joined the band so we could get some more tinkly bog action happening. And Drosma was a very creative and talented person. Everything she did had a kind of creative element. She could write and draw. She wore the most amazing clothes. I think it was incredibly playful. We swapped instruments all the time. You'll hear very strange little instruments or even a violin in the background. I think we deliberately didn't want a drummer. It wasn't even a creative choice. It was just not having a drummer was less of a hassle. In fact, there was only about two drummers at the time. Every instrument was a thing to play with, not necessarily play the way we saw other people playing it. And I think Lindsay enjoyed the fact that there wasn't any pressure to create rock music. I think we lasted about 4 months. I think tops 6 months, tops. Quite a long time, really, for a small band. Some bands lasted a week. We're off and on first, so usually about four people did see us. So it's lucky we did record, because in total about 15 people would have seen Tam and Mirrors during its lifespan. M Squared was located around the corner in Wiltshire Street, very close. And I think the M Squared boys wanted to put an album together of music that was being played, some of which were bands that weren't necessarily part of the label. It was a great little recording studio. It was a terrace house, and it felt very intimate and relaxed. I mean, if I'd thought about it, I would have been too terrified to even walk in the door. But they were such lovely people.
M Squared started in December 1979.
In a small terrace house in Wiltshire Street, Surrey Hills, a recording studio was set up in 1979, then to become an independent label, M Squared. Through releases like the compilation A Selection, M Squared played an essential role in capturing the inner Sydney post-punk sound. M Squared founders, Michael Coffey and Mitch Jones.
At the time, he felt there was something changing, and the way of delivering music, making music, is all dated, and there must be a better way, and we're going to find a better way. Around the corner was Roger Greeson of Doublethink. We thought, well, Roger can do it, or we could do it, sort of thing. And, you know, he gave us some advice, so we decided on the name. We thought, right, we're a label. The initial vision was we'd release material we'd like. At the time, I felt that it didn't matter what sort of style, if there was passion and a belief and an honesty behind it, that'll always shine through. I didn't want some sort of pastiche of what people think might be successful or what people think other people might want to hear at the time.
There was these record shops in the inner city of Sydney and in the city of Melbourne that we could put our records in. There was Anthem Records, Record Plant, Phantom, White Light.
The Vessels album by the makers of the Dead Troll Fast was the only LP that went into a second pressing.
Patrick Gibson, with synthesizer and recordings under arm, turned up on the M Squared doorstep one day and was soon part of the team.
Yeah, it just seemed like the three of us clicked together. I seemed to kind of osmose into their orbit down kind of a side street off was it Devonshire Street?
It was in a little lane. There was only three terrace houses together, and the rest around it was businesses. Yeah, it was just one of those tiny terraces without a hallway, so when you knocked on the door, it could be disturbing, because originally the band was in the front room, so you had to sort of sit out there and wait for a gap in music before you could knock, so if anybody to hear you. There's no sort of talk back or anything between the two rooms, so there's, on all these recordings, there's people yelling out, rolling through the door. At the beginning, we had a four-track reel-to-reel tape recorder, a little mixing console, a selection of microphones. We borrowed somebody's nice home stereo for some monitors and a few effects units, and that was it. We just, I think we put a bit of padding up on some walls, but there was hardly any soundproofing. We just moved in and sort of started making noise.
Late-night experiments in the tiny studio evolved into the band Scattered Order.
Scattered Order was a way of making a good lot of racket and a lot of noise, yeah.
Scattered Order was always the sort of knife edge between tune and noise. I wanted to be involved with a band that made music I heard in my head, but how to sort of get it from the head to to my hands is another thing I'm still trying.
We used to call it white noise with a beat, and when we used to record, we'd do things deliberately, like boosting particular frequencies, like 2K in a way, that was our motto, just to make it a little bit more gnarly.
Scattered Order used to think of themselves as the builders, labourers of the avant-garde, if I recall.
Yeah, we play with our thumbs.
The first release on M Squared was by Patrick's group, The Systematics, titled Rural, striking cover designed by M Squared's in-house designer, Drusilla Jones. It hit the stores in October 1980.
Something called Rural, with these two kids standing behind a denuded tree. I mean, there's some kind of joke going on there. We did take what we were doing seriously, but we weren't necessarily taking ourselves seriously. I don't think it's my imagination, but no one else seems to be able to recall it. Someone referred to Rural as sounding like Captain Beefheart meeting John Cage in a darkened recording studio. I don't know where it came from, frankly. It is pretty bleak, some of it.
I've got no legs and I've got no shoulders. Mother says I'll change when I'm older. She explains that it's just my age and that I'm passing through a phase. But for the meanwhile, I'm myself. Mother says I'm looking well as she puts food under the door. I won't embarrass her no more.
I don't know, I think we should be known as that odd little label from Sydney who had fun and released, you know, some pretty good records.
Put me in a suit. Wash my hair. Give me a pipe. Sit me in an armchair, cut my wrists.
Across the harbour from M Squared, in the leafy North Shore suburb of Mossman, one of the most influential outfits from the Sydney post-punk scene was evolving, the Severed Heads. Frontman, Tom Ellard.
Well, okay, we made up the name Severed Heads as a joke. Myself and Richard Fielding, I was working with a guy called Richard, and he was in HSC year, and I was in year five. It was year 11, they call it now. And we were going under a bunch of names which were just designed to irritate people. And we decided to make a cassette and send it to the radio. So we sent it to Peter Doyle at Double J, and he said, well, we can't call ourselves Mr. and Mrs. No Smoking Sign. Why don't we come up with an industrial name? So we called ourselves Severed Heads because it was the most stupid and banal name we could think of, wrote it on the cassette, sent it in, and he played the whole thing from beginning to end, which, of course, you can't do on radio these days. So that was pretty much our first appearance in life. We played live for the first time at the beginning of 1980, and that was at a friend's kind of warehouse on Forbes Street. Oh, we had lots of tape recorders and simple keyboards and televisions and radios and things. So you'd get a bit of radio and you'd stick it through a tape, and then you might get the tape and run it through a keyboard and then back onto tape again. And so it was a fairly free-form kind of jam thing. I'm sitting there with one of the very first sequences tapping out little melodies and trying things out. We didn't know what would happen. Certainly, Richard had a very strong distaste, I'll put it that way, for the music industry and for musicianship and all of that. So he was the person who said, we're not going to rehearse and we're not going to do the rock. We're not going to do the rock and roll thing. We're just going to show up and we're going to do our thing. And it's kind of funny because when Richard decided to leave, he became, in his own words, a roadie for the equipment, which he called the Nobodies. And so the Nobodies would play and he would just load them in, put them on the trestle table, start them up and walk away because he was just the roadie. I saw the film The Conversation in 1975, which, if you've seen it, involves a lot of tape recorder editing and repasting and recopying. And so for me, the tape recorder became the steam engine or the home computer of the generation before or after me. It was the tape recorder that became the obsessive device that I wanted to use. And so I collected a lot of old tape recorders and cut and splice and did all the radiophonic kind of treatments, which I didn't know much about. And it was always infuriating to find out that somebody else had already invented tape loops or putting a piece of cardboard over the record head or rubbing alcohol on the tape to make it kind of stretch and all the techniques you had to use. So certainly it was the same spirit that made people pick up all these other objects. At that particular time, the tape recorder was the thing that did it. So I do blame The Conversation. My environment, it was radio, television, the sounds of where I lived, and so that's what I used. There was a very Australian accent to it, and there was a lot of voice talent who were doing the ochre, you know, where do you get it kind of stuff. And so I want to be quite clear that it's not a matter of appropriation. I never thought about somehow grabbing something and making some political mileage with it. That was just where I lived. That's it. It's field recording, except field recording of radio. In 1977, the first Radio Shack computer became available, and I picked up one of those and used it to make music with. It had no arrow shielding in it at all, so every time you used it, every radio in the whole neighborhood would hear what I was doing. no matter how noisy it might sound to you, or no matter how kind of like art brute it might be according to some critic, it's pop music. It's music that I like to play. It's very hard to sum this up in a few sentences, but it's part of a modernism. The tape recorders were a modernist thing. The synthesizers were a modernist thing. I mean, there's a certain modernistic progressive thrust through the whole thing from the beginning. Our loud and obnoxious noises have always been one of putting on a good firework display for the entertainment of all. I am not a very angry person. We would say, is the world as stupid, fragmented, mixed up, crazy, I don't know what the hell's going on, as it seems, and who cares? In other words, it's just a random thing. And this is a really interesting point, because we saw everything as being random in a very positive way. We would say, you may as well do anything, but do it well. We would be inspired by randomness.
It's remarkably good fun just playing on stage. I mean, we, as I say, we never took ourselves too seriously, and we would have fun with the audience, and the audience would have fun with us, and it was all quite a pleasant, sociable experience as well. We never got beaten up.
I've been looking so hard, my hands are sore, but all fingers are empty, and my friends still born, boys, feet on the ground, hands in the air, in this place, don't mind my shadow, baby.
A mainstream rock writer would seek a narrative where people start a band, they record, they go on Countdown, they tour for the next 20 years. And I don't think this period and the people that I played with were interested in that, but they were certainly interested in being part of this enormously rich creative time, because music had died and something had to rise.
If I could buy for my house, it must have been this great. I have dignity in my labors for that. House is my pride, and the house is my joy. House is my life, and the house is my house. I'm gonna die for this house. I'm gonna die for this house. I'm going to protect this house. I'm gonna die for this house.
You've been listening to part one of Do That Dance, the post-punk music movement, which emerged in Australia in the late 1970s. Our thanks to all those who took part in today's feature, which explored the movement in Sydney. The series was written and produced by Sean O'Brien, and the sound engineer was Stephen Tilley. Next week, in the final part of the series, Sean travels to Melbourne to uncover how post-punk developed in that city. And in marked contrast to the scene in Sydney, in Melbourne the movement was defined by distinct locations and ideologies. The North Fitzroy Beat, St Kilda's Crystal Ballroom, Art Project Gallery's Anti-Music, and the Clifton Hill Community Music Centre. South of the city's great divider, the Yarra River, post-punk was all about anarchy and excess, whereas in the inner north suburbs, the tenor was more one of intellectual restraint. Join me for part two of Do That Dance on Hindsight next week here on ABC Radio National.
The French officials would take coffins with them because they knew it was so likely that they would not come out alive.
The human cost of building the Panama Canal was enormous, but ultimately it became the engineering marvel of its day.
Teddy Roosevelt saw the possible Panama Canal as a tremendous boost to American naval power, as well as a great help to American commerce.
The story of the Panama Canal, Rear Vision, and you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.